Carolyn Parks was a very young teenage mother back in the 1950s. She lived in a small house in Texas. No car, no TV, not many friends, nowhere to go. She was 13, turning 14 years old, and home with a baby daughter.
I can remember one time sitting by the window and looking out at the night and listening to a train in the distance and just longing for something different.
In the years since then, Carolyn has worried that she wasn't a very good mother, that she'd been too young to raise her girl properly. But years later, her daughter gave her a gift, one that said, "Hey, Mom, you did just fine." I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
This weekend, mothers will get their cards and flowers and thank yous from children as people mark Mother's Day, the one day set aside to honor the women who raise us. There was a time when Carolyn Parks probably felt like she didn't deserve much thanks from her daughter. Back in the mid-50s, she was living in Lubbock, Texas. She got pregnant and married when she was very young.
I was 13. That sounds like our family was really trashy or something when I say that, but actually, my parents had, they owned their own business. We always had a maid at home. I never thought about marriage or anything. I don't think that I ever, you know, saw it like that. But he was 18 and was just a lot more serious than I was and really pushed for it. In fact, at a certain point after we had been, you know, like they called it in those days, going with each other,
Yeah. At
a certain point I really wanted to date someone else, but I asked his permission, which, you know, of course now I realize that was very silly,
Yeah. But
at the time I did, and he actually threatened to kill himself if I, you know, went with someone else or something.
So here you were, 13 years old, he was 18. It's almost like he intimidated you into continuing that relationship, perhaps on even into marriage.
Well, maybe so, but he really was a very gentle, kind person, and was very good to me and a very good little father when we were, you know, after we were married.
Carolyn Park says she wasn't much aware of it at the time, but now that she's older, she sees more clearly what was going on in her home and why it was that tension between her parents made it easy for her and easy for them to have her leave.
I think the problem was the fact that at that time, not for many years now, but at that time, my mother was alcoholic, and she was a binge drinker. And the old saying is that everyone is watching after the drinker rather than anyone else. And I had a stepfather that was the one really that raised me until I married. And he was quite violent with my mother when she would drink. But she often left us for periods of time and then would come back. And when she came back, then, as I say, he would really beat her.
Gosh, you were so young at that time, Carolyn.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was pretty terrible waiting for her to come back and her not to come back. And my stepfather had a way of always making it seem like it was my fault.
When things got loud, violent in the house, what did you do?
I don't remember.
But you do remember those incidents. It's not
like you didn't leave
the house, for example.
Yes, and I remember the aftermath. I remember when my mother was pregnant with one of my half-brothers, and I remember the huge bruises on her body.
It was Carolyn Park's father who made the arrangements for his daughter to marry. At the time, Carolyn was 13. The boy was 18.
I don't know whether it was kind of to cover the tracks or what it was, but he was the one that took us, and we got our license in one place, and then we were married in another place, and then he took us to Carlsbad Caverns for our honeymoon.
This may seem like a silly question, Carolyn, but was it legal to marry a 13-year-old girl?
Oh, no. But and I don't know whether he lied about my age or whether just signing was all that was needed from a parent. I was actually pregnant when we got married, and that, of course, was the real catalyst for the whole
thing. Did you know you were pregnant?
No, not really, but my mother recognized it.
How did your life change?
Well, I couldn't go to school. You know, they didn't allow a married person, much less anyone that was pregnant. And at first, I was very satisfied keeping our house, our little nest. And I just kept the house, kept the baby, and that was, you know, the extent of it.
Not being able to go to school, did you then have to give up on all the other kids who'd been your friends?
I really didn't have a lot of friends. I had one girlfriend, and she and I stayed friends, and we continued our friendship.
How were you as a mother at that age?
Well, you know, I just took care of her, and of course I have a lot of guilty feelings about, you know, about some things, you know, like weaning her too early, expecting her to be potty trained too early. One time when she was 9 months old, and she was always such a good baby, but this particular night she just kept waking up crying and crying. And I went in and popped her little legs. And the next
spanked
morning,
her, you mean?
Not like you would spank a 3 or 4 year old or something. But the next morning she had an ear infection. And so you can imagine how I felt and the guilt that I felt all these years.
I mean, I'm going to cut you a little bit of slack here. Your baby was 9 months old, but you were 14. What did you know?
Well, and you know, now, having had grandchildren, you know, seeing them at 14, and, you know, I'm not so critical of myself, but that particular thing, if we keep talking about that, I'm going to start crying.
I'm interested in knowing what it was like for you as a young mother at home with a little baby. This would have been back in the 50s. I mean, what did you do during the day?
You know, I really don't know. I cleaning my little house and taking care of the baby. And
I mean, was the library close by? Could you get books?
No, no.
Did you have a television?
No.
Did you have a car?
Well, we did, but my husband had to have it for work.
And so you must have been kind of just stuck at home, you and the baby.
House cleaning took a lot of your time in those days. And, of course, I didn't have a washer or anything, and I had to go down to my mother's and use her washer and hang things out on the line.
Including the diapers.
Yes, including the diapers. We didn't have paper diapers.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Carolyn Parks was young, 13, when her daughter, Jay-Ann, was born. And as she was saying earlier, she was often very lonely. One day, she dragged out her old collection of paper dolls, the paper dolls she'd been playing with just a few years earlier.
You know, I can't imagine how I still had those things, but yeah, one day I was bored, and I did. I dragged my paper dolls out, my old paper dolls from a home, and started playing with them. And I was really, really embarrassed. In fact, I think I closed the curtains. And I certainly was worried about somebody coming to the door. I was really, really embarrassed about it.
These were paper dolls that you'd had as a little girl yourself, right?
Right, right.
And the games that you played, was it to make clothes for them? How did you play with them?
Well, that day I just, you know, played like girls play with their Barbies. Of course, we used to lay them down and trace around them and design clothes for them. I mean, this was really, truly left over from the time that I was a little girl.
And your daughter would have been very, very young at this point. It's not
mm-hmm.
like you,
yes,
the two of you
just
were playing together with the dolls, right?
No, she was really just a baby. She, you know, she was asleep or something, and I guess I did get bored and got them out.
Carolyn, this marriage of yours didn't end well. What happened?
Well, we were married for a couple of years, and I just was unhappy. I can remember one time sitting by the window and looking out at the night and listening to a train in the distance and just longing for something different. I didn't really know what, but just something different. And eventually my husband lost his job, and he was a high school dropout, and he lost his job. And I think that was just finally the catalyst that I just took my daughter and I just went home. And my mother hadn't been really happy about me marrying him and into his family. And so she was very, very glad for me to come back home. And I feel, this is another thing that I feel so guilty about, because all of my decisions at that time were about myself and not my daughter.
Years later, Carolyn Parks told her daughter Jayanne that story, the story of playing with those paper dolls, even after she'd become a mother herself. Carolyn didn't know it at the time, but it was to be the story of those dolls that prompted a surprise and most welcome gift from her daughter. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Leading up to this weekend's Mother's Day, my guest is Carolyn Parks. She's telling the story of her own motherhood, and it's not what she thought it would be. She had a rough home life in Northwest Texas. She got pregnant, married, and had her baby all when she was 13 years old. And so think about this. These days, Carolyn's in her mid-60s, and her daughter Jayanne is in her 50s.
Well, people have asked me if it was more like a if she was more like my sister, but that's not true at all. I always felt very motherly toward her, but yes, we are very close.
Carolyn was telling me earlier about how one day, when she was this extremely young mother, she was so lonely she brought out her old paper dolls to play with. Now, she'd also told that story to her daughter. And when Jayanne was grown up, she sent her mother an unexpected Christmas gift.
It was a box, a large box, covered with tapestry, and it was decorated with lace, and it had beautiful ribbons and strings of beads. And I thought, oh, well, this is beautiful. This will be kind of a treasure box, so to speak, for jewelry maybe or something like that. And when I opened it, it was these beautiful, beautiful period paper dolls. And there was a layer for each one that told about each one.
You're talking
and,
really, really fancy little paper dolls here.
Oh, and they weren't so little either. They were about maybe 9 inches tall, but they were very, very intricate. And it had the story of each one because she's also a writer. And they each one had their own little wardrobe with them, too. And they were just beautiful. And, of course, the minute that I looked, I knew what she was telling me because I had told her a few years before that about getting those paper dolls out. I'd actually forgotten about it. Really, truly, I was so embarrassed about doing it that I had just never told anybody and eventually had forgotten about it. And then something triggered it and I remembered it and I had told her about it. And when I talked to her recently, I said, what made you do that after those years? And she said that I was always so critical of myself and that that it had been a very difficult and wonderful and selfless thing to do. And she said, my daughter said, that she just wanted to celebrate the little girl inside of me that had never gotten to be, which was very, very touching to me, as you can imagine.
Wow, what a gift.
Yes, yes, it really was. And it's the one gift that that my granddaughters here always want to go to. And I say, never. This is the one thing in my house that you can never drag out.
Carolyn, can you take me back to the moment when you opened that box? You're looking at these paper dolls. Your daughter wasn't there. Was there anyone else in the room?
Oh, yes. Our family was gathered around. It was, it was Christmas, and we were all gathered there.
And did they know what was going on? Did they know what was being exchanged between you and your daughter?
No.
Did you tell them?
Well, I told my daughter here later. And I told my husband, but I don't know if anybody else could get it. I've told a couple of friends, and I haven't told it very often. I think that's one reason that I wanted to tell the story to you, because the people around me, the few people that I shared it with, because I'm still pretty embarrassed a little bit about the situation, although the gift was wonderful, I just don't think most of them really got it. And maybe nobody can. Maybe nobody can understand that that bond and what it meant. When I opened them, the first thing I did was laugh. I really did, because it was kind of a joke also between my daughter, even though it was touching.
So this was a Christmas gift. Did you call your daughter?
Oh yes, very, very soon after that.
And?
Well, I just told her how beautiful it was, and in fact she teased and she said that that if she had known how much effort and time it was going to take, maybe she wouldn't have done it, but she was joking.
I mean, you said to me a couple of moments ago that the gift was her way of celebrating the little girl in you, the little girl who had raised her when she was born.
Well, I think that she just meant that there had been some sacrifice to be her mother at that age, and to see that she was fed and cleaned and cared for, and that I stayed with her and, you know, never tried to abandon her or anything.
And still you kind of beat yourself up about that time.
Well, some of the things. I'm more mature now, and of course I've had education now, and you know, I understand more about parenting and things like that. I have to also give my mother a lot of credit too, even though, you know, there were some people back in the 50s, and probably my stepfather would have been one of them, that would have turned you out if you had gotten pregnant.
And they didn't do that to you?
No.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. This gift of the paper dolls helped Carolyn Parks come to terms with some of the guilt that she'd had for being such a young mother.
You know, I can tell myself now that anybody that started dating at 10 or 11 years old, naturally, is going to, it's not going to have a happy ending.
Tell me, Carolyn, on a quiet afternoon, will you take out that box of dolls now?
No. I have it in a prominent place in my living room, and I know what's there, what's inside, and I just look at it, and it just brings back a flood of love and appreciation and memories and a little private joke, too.
But it's kind of, in a way, like your daughter has given you permission as a grown-up to play with those dolls and not be guilty the way that you were when you were such a young mom.
Yes, I guess you could say that.
But you pretty well keep the box closed.
Yes, I do. There's no reason to open it. I know what's there.
Carolyn Parks wrote in from her home in Bellevue, Nebraska, to tell me the story about the paper dolls. One of those great examples of someone who knows she has a great story and then chooses to share it with the rest of us. If you have one, you can go to our website and let me know about it. You'll find us at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Our next story is also one for Mother's Day. Leon Prochnick says he has much to thank his mother for. See, Leon was born into a Jewish family in Poland, and it was ultimately up to his mother to see that the family escaped Nazi occupation.
She said, don't say a word of German. I mean, both my cousin and I were like, we could have been poster children for the Third Reich. We were very blonde, blue-eyed kids. But, of course, we did speak German. She said, you don't say a word. Let me do all the talking. She pretended she didn't speak German. They searched our cart. She had a little Bible in Hebrew there, which, of course, if they had found, they would have immediately either shot us or taken us back, whatever they would have done.
Leon's family was well off. They owned a chocolate factory in Krakow. Leon starts this story with his recollection of the life they used to live.
We had our own nanny. We had our own cook. My father loved to collect Persian carpets and little art objects that he was constantly finding. There was a grand piano in the living room. It was the closest I ever came to seeing anything like it, strangely enough, when I saw Schindler's List and there was a Jewish family is being moved out of an apartment so Schindler can move in. And I went, oh, my God, that looks the way our apartment used to look. Yeah.
And what would be your memory of the first time when you thought, something is amiss here, something's not right?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I remember coming into the living room. I think it was our living room. The whole family was there, and they were listening to the radio, a very staticky sounding thing. And I heard this man shrilly shouting in German, and it sounded scary, and I could pick up the tension of the adults, and I remember asking my mother what was going on, and she said, it's all right, it's not important, it's, you know, go back to your room or go back to your cousins and play. And that was Hitler, who I was hearing on the radio.
There's always something so unsettling when you're a child and you see that the adults are upset, you know. It sounds
right.
Like you were seeing that at that time.
I was seeing that. My sister and my older cousin, they were both older than I was. I remember them talking about if there was a war, who would be better off, because we lived on the top floor. So if bombs were dropped, we would be the first ones killed. But if they dropped gas, which rises, we would be better off because we were on the fourth floor. But to me, that was all like fun and games. I mean, I just didn't think there was anything terribly serious.
And how long would it have been before it was quite clear that the family was going to have to change its lifestyle, that people were going to have to move, or that there were soldiers in the street or planes flying overhead? What do you recall of that?
Well, it happened virtually overnight. We were in vacation in a place called Zakopane, which is a famous resort in Poland. And we got news that the war had broken out. That would have been the beginning, very beginning of September 1939. And a decision was made not to go back to Krakow, but to try to go somewhere else, further away from the big cities. And so we never went back home. And overnight, we were fleeing, basically. And we end up in this little town called Helm, where we had some distant relatives. There was a Jewish ghetto there. So we're four in a room, you know, after. It's a tremendous shift that goes on. And it's here that the war becomes real, because a few days later, it'll happen very quickly. The Russians invaded Poland from the other side. Germany was coming from the west. They were coming from the east. And a week after that, Poland surrendered. And I do remember standing in the street and seeing the remnants of the Polish army leaving. It was all carts and horses and limping men. And I think the very next day, in came the Germans with their bright boots and very organized and very scary looking. And so we were under German occupation.
Leon, I've talked to some people who were children at that time in war, and some have memories that aren't really so full of fear because the parents, the adults, worked so hard to try and lessen that fear for the children. Some kids at that moment, despite the kind of danger that their families are in, have recollections of it as kind of an exciting moment. This is, you know, what's going to happen next?
Yeah, it was, Dick. It was at the beginning, I found it very exciting. In fact, I remember one time during an air raid, this was before the Germans actually marched in when they were still bombing and so forth, and I either got left behind or got out of the air raid shelter too soon, and I saw this German plane coming down. I just stood there looking up at him. I mean, I could literally see the pilot's face as he zoomed up over me, and I thought, whoa, this is kind of cool. This is kind of exciting. And then we found a pistol. My sister and my cousin found a German Luger pistol, and they knew that if anybody was found with any kind of firearm, they would be shot on the spot. This was after the Germans had already come in, and we had to find a place to bury the pistol, and we did it like in the evening when nobody else was around. And it was, yeah, that felt very, very, very exciting. So the first part of it, up to that point, it did feel like fun and games to me.
And the fact that your family had some money, did that buy you time? Because some wealthy Jewish families were targeted simply because they had that wealth, and others were able to kind of hold off the inspections a little bit, whether it was through bribery or connections or whatever. What happened in the case of your family?
We actually had to run so fast that we had very, very little money. I mean, I remember my mother took whatever jewelry she had along with her, you know, when we were on vacation, and odds and ends like that. And in fact, there was a kind of funny story. My grandmother had the main amount of money, like the egg nest or whatever. She
the nest egg, had ten,
yeah. Yeah, nest egg, excuse me. I'll learn English one day. She had about $10,000 in her possession, and once the Germans came into Helm, they started coming to the house at unexpected times to requisition things, to look around. And one day when the Germans were coming, my grandmother took that $10,000 she had and she wrapped it up in a rag and she threw it in the oven, hid it there. The Germans poked around, didn't find anything. They left, and then she opened the oven and the money was burned to a crisp. Every penny we had was gone. So past that point, we really were surviving on just in the most minimal sort of way.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. When the Prochnik family decided it was time to flee, Leon was still a young boy, and he was very attached to the family nanny. So it was only later, sorting out affections, that he realized just how strong his mother had been.
The awareness of my mother's heroism and what she did took many years to really, really fully register with me. I was brought up, and so was my sister, by our nanny, who was Polish Catholic, very, very warm, special woman. And when we came to this point where we were going to have to part ways, since she was going to stay in Poland, she asked my mother if she could take me with her.
The nanny did? Said,
the nanny did, yeah. Huh. And I wanted to go with her because she was the one I identified really as being my mother in terms of personal interaction. Of course, my mother, you know, said, no way, you know, can't happen. Yeah. And I think for many, many years, I felt a tremendous sadness at having lost the nanny, and also a kind of, I can't say it was a resentment at my mother about that, but certainly enough of a feeling so that it really took many years to really, really fully register with me. In fact, at one point, I was talking about this escape to a friend and saying how painful that separation was at that point. And this friend of mine said, look, your mother saved your life. If you had gone with your nanny, I mean, there's a very good chance you wouldn't have survived the war. And I think at that point, it really hit me. And I realized, you know, what an amazing thing she had done.
I'll talk more with Leon Prochnik in just a moment, and we'll hear the details of the family's escape, the courage and the strength of character displayed by Leon's mother, what Leon calls the amazing thing she did. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In recognition of Mother's Day, we're listening to a story today of a mother's courage in wartime. Leon Prochnik's family made a dramatic escape from Poland during the Second World War, and their survival is due in large part to the ingenuity of Leon's mother. You see, when the war broke out, Leon's family was in a town in eastern Poland called Chełm. There was a river nearby that separated Poland from the Soviet Union, and back then civilians were trying to figure out where they'd be safe. Control of Chełm went back and forth under the Germans, under the Russians, and then it was the Nazis again.
The Germans moved back in to stay. And when that happened and the Russians went off across this river to their side of the border, the men in our family went with them. There was the fear, the word had gotten out that men were being rounded up and sent to labor camps. So the men in our family, my father and my uncles, walked out behind the Russian army with the idea that as soon as they could, they would send for us to join them. Meanwhile, we were to stay put in Chełm and wait for them to send for us.
At this point, Leon Prochnik was waiting with his mother and the whole family on the other side of the river. They were unaware of the danger they were in until they got a visitor.
One of the families that had marched out with the Russian army were friends of my mother's. And the man was a doctor. His wife, at the last moment, had asked my mother to hold or hide the doctor's bag for them. I don't know what they thought they were going to do, come back for it, or they couldn't carry all the stuff they had. But one night there was a knock on our door. This was a few weeks after the men had left. And this woman was there, and she said to my mother, "Look, do you still have my husband's bag? Because we're over on the other side, but without his doctor's bag, he can't practice." And my mother did have the bag and gave it to this woman, who was very grateful. And then this woman said, "What are you still doing here?" And my mother said, "Well, we're waiting. We're waiting for our husbands to send for us." This woman said, "You can't wait. You cannot wait. We've been hearing terrible stories. They're starting to round up Jews. They're starting to kill them. You have to get out now." So my mother was culturally sort of the norm, who relied on the man to make the decisions in the family, now had to decide whether she was going to press this case with my aunts and my grandparents. And she took this notion to them that we needed to escape now, and they said the same thing she had said the night before. "No, we have to wait for the men. We can't, blah, blah, blah." And she said, "No, we have to go. We're going to go." So my mother actually at that point saved our lives, because if we had stayed, there is almost no question at all that we would have all been killed.
We're talking about the autumn of 1939. How much was known then about the concentration camps, the death camps? I mean, when you're sitting there on the river and the Germans are occupying your town and you're thinking, you know, "Well, we'll wait and see if we can get across this river to join the men on the other side." Did you know to fear the trains coming or the soldiers coming?
Oh, no. Nobody at that point knew. There were no death camps really yet. I mean, that would come a little later. But I remember walking down the street one day with my sister and our nanny, who was still with us at that point. She had kind of escaped with us. And we came around the corner, and there were some German soldiers with a bunch of old Jewish people on the street, on their hands and knees, being forced to scrub off some graffiti or signs or whatever it was, and they were kicking them. And there was no question that this was very, very bad business. So the word was out that things were bad. In fact, we had to escape in separate groups, and there was like an underground railroad, I mean, where you paid the people who were smuggling you out to get you across the other side. My mother probably hocked one piece of jewelry she had or whatever she did. And we were being taken out in a cart. I mean, there was something out of Tolstoy. I mean, just this hay cart, you know, with a pair of horses, and stopped by German sentries, with my mother having the presence of mind to pretend that she didn't speak any German, because the German soldiers assumed that if a Polish person understood German, they were probably Jewish, because Yiddish, the Jewish language, is actually based on German.
So not only did your mother have to lead the entire remainder of the family, but then she had to be the one to talk you through the German lines to get to the river?
Absolutely. Absolutely. She said, don't say a word of German. I mean, both my cousin and I were like, we could have been poster children for the Third Reich. We were very blonde, blue-eyed kids. Oh. But of course, we did speak German. She said, you don't say a word. Let me do all the talking. She pretended she didn't speak German. They searched our cart. She had a little Bible in Hebrew there, which of course they had found. They would have immediately either shot us or taken us back, whatever they would have done. And as we were going towards the river, a man comes up on horseback, and he says to the guy who is taking us out, who was Jewish, he says to him, Shmuel, or whatever the guy's name was, listen, they've started rounding up the Jews. They've been all told to report to this forest. They're rounding them up. And this man who was taking us out could very easily have said, look, here's your money back, or sorry, folks, this is as far as I can take you. My family's back there. And it was one of those many existential moments during our escape where he just hung on a thread, and he hesitated and said, no, I promise these people I'd take them as far as the river. I'm going to do that. He took us to the river. He went back. Chances are that he ended up being killed along with almost virtually like 95% of the inhabitants of Helm, Jewish inhabitants, were murdered.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Leon Prochnik says it was his mother's determination that got the family out of Poland just ahead of the time when the Jews were being rounded up and sent to the death camps. Leon's father had gone ahead, but to get out of Poland, the rest of the family still had to cross the river.
It was dangerous. We, in fact, were delayed for some reason, and so we fell behind the other group of people who were being taken across that day. We heard some shouting up ahead, and these people had been stopped by Russian soldiers and were being herded back with the idea that they would be sent back to the German side. That's what they used to do. They caught you. They would send you back to the German side.
How did you guys avoid that?
We stayed in hiding till later that evening, and we found a hut. It was, imagine what that was like then. I mean, no one had any idea where they were. You were totally at the mercy of a guide who might just abandon you, or you didn't speak the language, or suddenly somebody would come up to you pointing a gun. It was just, that, I think, was the thing that most people who I've shared the story with, only with friends till now, they always sit there, and I guess for them it's like watching a movie. And for me, when I think back on it, it is also like that.
How did you get across the river, Leon? How did you find your father and your uncles?
There was no communication, zero, no mail, no phones, nothing. I was too young to remember the technical details of it. I think once we got over to the Russian side, then there were some kind of phones there, and we were able to track them down. I think that the men were in Lvov, you know, that's part that is now is the Ukraine.
Once the Prochnik family had escaped from Poland, they tried to get as far away from the Germans as they could. They headed north towards Lithuania, where the Russian army still held sway.
We're traveling by sled at night, freezing temperature, so cold. This I do remember very clearly. There were just icicles hanging down from those scarves wrapped around our mouths and nose, where the vapor would just turn into ice. And I remember my parents being very concerned that my sister and I would fall asleep because it was so cold. That was one of the fears, that if it gets too cold, you just want to go to sleep. And if you fall asleep, maybe you're not going to wake up. So I remember my sister and I being made to stand on the runners of these horse-drawn sleds going through a wintry landscape, which never seemed to end. And on the Lithuanian border, we had found some kind of refuge in a hut. And the door burst open. This, again, I remember very vividly. And three Lithuanian soldiers, bayonets fixed, come in. Now, again, one of these miracles, although I've never particularly, I thought I've never believed in miracles, but one of these three soldiers turns out to be Jewish, which is incredible because in the whole Lithuanian army, maybe there were a couple of dozen Jews.
Yeah.
But this was one of these guys was, so he spoke Yiddish, which is sort of the international language, even, you know. And my father was able to bribe him and give him something and a bottle of schnapps or vodka or whatever it was, and they let us go.
Leon Prochnik's family made its way successfully to Lithuania. They were safer, but not yet in the clear.
We were there almost 8 months, but here's what the situation was in Vilno. They were under Russian occupation, and there was no specific anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic business going on.
Now, the Russian army was busy with other matters.
Busy with other matters. Well, no, they were. That was not their primary agenda, was not to go out and kill Jews. So actually, I went to school there for about 4 or 5 months in this little Jewish school where I don't even remember how I communicated with the other kids because I didn't speak Lithuanian, but I did make some very sweet friends, and I just recently looked at a photograph of me in that school. It was heartbreaking. It was a kindergarten class, just like you'd see here, like 20 or 30 kids. And after I looked at the picture a long time, I went on Google, and I just looked up the statistics, and it said of the 200,000 Jews who were in Lithuania before the war, less than 10,000 survived. So I could look at that photograph and know that 80, 90% of those children were killed.
Leon Prochnik's family eventually found its way out of Lithuania, and they settled in the United States. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Many years later, Leon's wife suggested he go back to Poland.
She one day said to me, look, for your 70th birthday, how about we go back to Krakow so that you can go back and see where you were born? And my reaction was, oh, no, no, I don't want to go. And
why? I'd want to go back.
No, no, you would think so. But actually, most Jews who escaped from Eastern Europe had almost zero desire to go back there. And I think it had to do with the almost institutionalized anti-Semitism that had existed in places like Poland or Hungary. And also, I think deeper than that even was that I felt that if I went back there, I'd be going back to pain because right outside of Krakow is Auschwitz. And if we went to Krakow, we would go to Auschwitz and all, you know, and I'd be reliving all this stuff. So my first reaction was, no, let's not, I don't want to do that. Let's go somewhere else. But my wife prevailed. We went to Krakow. The moment we got off the train in Krakow for the first time in 50 or 60 years, I found myself speaking Polish. We had an unbelievably wonderful stay there. And I actually got to go to the house where I was born.
The family home in Krakow, it was still standing. This is one that you'd never got back to, right? Because you'd been on vacation when the war...
Exactly. And I remember telling the cab driver, I gave him the address, and he sort of didn't pay attention, and he started to drive out of where we were staying, thinking probably, well, these American tourists, they probably just want to see the town. I said, no, it's that place. Please find out where that is. So he called his boss, and he found out, and he took us there. And we get out of the car, and this had been this very handsome building that had, during the war, had been used by the Gestapo as one of their offices. After the war, was cut up into these minuscule little apartments and looked very kind of dreary. But I went up to a guy downstairs, and then I said to him in Polish, look, I was born here, and maybe we can go in and kind of take a look around. And he said, sure. So he let me in, and my heart sank because one of my memories was that we had an elevator, which was very rare in Krakow before World War II. We had an elevator, and there was no elevator here. And I thought, this is the wrong building. And I said to him, Proszę pana, była tutaj wida, which is in Polish, like, excuse me, sir, wasn't there an elevator here? And he said, yeah, there. And he pointed to this door that to me was the size of a closet. And I thought, oh, my God, I remember this being like a gigantic, splendid elevator, you know, just like huge. And like in one moment, I realized that that had been a child's memory. That was the elevator. And as soon as I got that, this amazing thing happened. I just turned, and like a little puppy coming back from a walk, I ran up 4 flights of stairs to exactly the door of our apartment. Nobody had to tell me what floor it was on. Nobody had to tell me where the door was.
It's a good sprint for a 70-year-old man.
Well, and I knocked on the door, and this guy, I really pounded it. The guy looked startled. Again, I said to him in Polish, I said, "Excuse me, but I'm here from America with my wife. I was born here. And could we take a look around?" And he opened the door, and we walked in. And the place was so carved up and so tiny, I mean, his part of it, that you would have thought I would have been disappointed. But as I entered that house, I knew exactly where I was standing. I mean, I just knew that spot like my feet had been there 2 minutes before. And my heart was just bursting out of my chest. And I turned around, and I just started kissing my wife and saying, "Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for making me do this."
So your return to Poland didn't bring those shivers that you feared?
Well, it did. For instance, we went to the marketplace, and they had these stands there, and they were selling these little Jewish figurines, like rabbis with long beards and old Jewish ladies. And it sort of gave me the creeps, because it was sort of like when they used to have those things here in the United States from the days of the slavery, you know, little Uncle Tom figures. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I went in to get the tickets from Auschwitz from this very hip young woman, Polish woman, I mentioned that that had really upset me seeing those figurines there. And she said, "Yeah, first they killed them and then they turned them into dolls." And I thought, wow. Yeah. But anyway, we went to Auschwitz, and Auschwitz was very, very, you know, heartbreaking and frightening to see it. But I found myself maybe protectively almost detached.
You're glad you went back though, right, Leon?
Enormously glad, enormously glad. I'm a great believer in the transformative power of stories, and yet I never told this story. So going back to Krakow was part of that reconnecting with something that I sort of thought somebody else could be talking about. I was just a kid. The adults can tell that story. And then, of course, at a certain point very recently, it really hit me. There are no older people to tell this story. I'm the older person. I'm the elder now.
Before your mother died, did you ever thank her specifically for what she'd done to get the family out of Poland?
Yes. Yes, I did. On a number of occasions, acknowledged her for what she had done to save our lives.
Leon Prochnik lives in Los Angeles, where he works as a screenwriter. He wrote to tell me about his mother and the family's escape from Poland. Now, listening to Leon, you may also be thinking, hey, I should write to Dick about the time when. Easy to do. Go to our website, thestory.org, or you can call and leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. The story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Our researcher is Jeanette Arrowwood. Rachel McCarthy and Jen Nathan work as our audio editors. Our engineers are Al Wadarski and Peter Bombar. The story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of the story is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.